essentially distributed $35,000 in funds over the last 4 years. This effort is started at the end of last year's program. So our programs, the grants were all completed at the end of last summer. And so we started immediately planning on talking about what worked, what did not work in the last year, and put our planning efforts forward. In December is when we actually made the grants available to the community. And we did a lot of promoting out to community-based organizations, out to schools and other youth organizations. We went actually directly to a lot of folks and said, this is a great opportunity for your young people to really get great ideas. If they got great ideas that they want to get some money to help promote some community development, this is a great opportunity. In January, led by the Multnomah Youth Commission, there were four grant writing workshops. So with Pam Fahn at the Youth Planning Program and then all the youth commissioners, over 200 youth came to those workshops and to learn about how to write a grant, how to get money from the city so that they can do some great work. I had a chance to attend the one at NEA. We had over 50 people from the community attend. And the highlight for me was a group of youth who are 7 years old at James John Elementary who came and they spoke on their own behalf on saying that they would like to develop a program at their school that would help them with literacy between that for the students there and their parents who are non-native English speakers. And that was really powerful, especially when you have a seven-year-old standing up in front of a group of 50 people saying, this is what I want to do, and I want to figure out how to do it. In March, on March 2nd, all the applications were due, and they were then collated and given to the PCC students to be evaluated and with a rubric. And then February 8th is when that happened. 19 different youth organizations submitted applications, which is the most since 2008 and the second most that we've ever had. And then they were compiled and given to the PCC Sylvania Social Movements class along with the rubric for evaluation. On March 2nd is actually when the PCC students came in and presented their findings to a group of the selection committee, which was made up of NYC youth and youth planners. And after 3.5 hours of very, very intense discussion and debate over each of these, they came up with a final slate of 11 grantees. The awards will be handed out this Friday. I'm going to hold off on telling you who the awardees are until then because we want to make sure that it's an announcement that's special for them as well. But 11 awardees this year will be receiving funding for the Youth Action Grants. And this work is just beginning for those awardees because all their work will need to be done by June 30th. What I'd like to highlight in that Youth Action Grant, what you'll hear today from our folks who are testifying, is that this grant does a lot in terms of how young people come together to make change in their communities. It is an amazing approach in terms of what equity means in our city. When we look at how these grants are distributed and to whom they're distributed to, this really aligns well with our work. And this is a great opportunity to look at what Youth Action Grants could mean for the city on an ongoing basis. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over now to Daisy Quiñones, who's going to speak on behalf of the Multnomah Youth Commission.
Hello. Good afternoon or morning. For the record, my name is Daisy Quiñones. I'm a senior at David Douglas High School, and I am co-chair of the Multnomah Youth Commission. Youth Action Grants are a completely youth-driven process. Youth create the application. They create the standards for it. They also promote the grant around the city. They provide and facilitate grant writing workshops. They write the grants themselves and judge and award the grants. And this is only one of the few youth-driven processes such as these nationwide. And the city of Portland, by allowing this to be a fully youth-controlled process, really shows that you have trust in youth and that you are invested in fostering positive relationships with youth throughout the city. And it also shows that the city of Portland is invested and they trust youth with their abilities to create positive change. And in respect to the Multnomah Youth Commission and the role it has in promoting the grants, we go around and we promote the grants around the city. We facilitate the grant writing workshops, and we also participate with youth planners in doing this. We're part of the selection committee also along with youth planners, and we are here today to share what a great investment you have made. The Youth Action Grant simultaneously teaches and builds community. In this process, there's a lot of skill building that takes place. The Youth Action Grant teaches youth in the community the importance of advocating and organizing in their communities, how to collaborate with adults and communicate and community organizations, and grant writing and the value of civic engagement towards making their communities better. The youth who organize and administer the grant learn about the importance of civic giving and the crucial importance of ensuring equitable distribution of public resources. And when you're thinking about this, consider the positive impact that the Youth Action Grants will have in the youth who receive these grants. And think about and consider how positive the impact will be as they become adults. In doing this, the City of Portland really helps create youth who become productive and engaged adults. And this year, the James John Elementary School will be awarded $600. And this was a really special project that Todd talked a bit about. It's a bilingual reading competition. It was brought up by first and second graders. The idea is to bring Spanish and English speaking students to learn alongside their parents who don't speak English because their parents want to be involved with their school and so forth, but it's really difficult when they don't speak English. And the principal of John James Elementary School, Beth Shelby, is really ecstatic about welcoming the growing number of Spanish speakers in her school and have them become active participants in the education and learning, and she's excited about having them become, and she's excited about the positive participation of education and learning of her students. The Youth Action Grant is actively including youth in this equitable process, and this process demonstrates what it really means for youth to give back to the community in tangible and equitable ways. And I would like to invite you all to the Youth Action Grant Award Ceremony on Friday, March 18th at 5:30 right here in City Council Chambers, where the awardees will be awarded. And you're all welcome to come, and hopefully we will all see you there. Thank you.
Nice job. My name's Kim Smith, and I'm a sociology professor at Portland Community College. Thank you for all your support for our college and for the work that you do. I appreciate your point about impact. We have a great opportunity here, and I don't know if you've thought about it in this way, to have value-added impact with the money. Each time the money is given to my students, they learn about the whole process of what does it mean to allocate resources. And I'm going to give a little bit of history on that. Then, in terms of giving the money to the youth, engaging them, empowering them to see how to use the money, then the money gets invested into the actual projects. We don't even know the value-added benefits as that ripples out, right? So it's actually, you actually educate three groups of people and then have community impact. So there's four ways that that money actually is then invested. So I really want you to think about it in that way. And that money's actually been decreasing over time, so I think it'd be worthy a goal to actually think about ways that we can increase the amount that we give out to our youth through our Youth Action Grants. Basic history on this. So yes, we've been working on this since 2008, but PCC actually first got involved with this through the Students for Giving campaign because five colleges in the nation were chosen by Fidelity Bank to develop a philanthropy program. There was a commitment through Fidelity for youth colleges specifically to learn about how to invest in their communities and how to develop a spirit of philanthropy. And we were the only community college in the nation to receive this grant out of the five grants. And so that is still going on, where the students at PCC develop the resources, do the fundraising, develop the whole RFP process, review the grants, and that's for nonprofits, for adult programs. And then the city learned about, and Pam and folks learned about our project and asked if we would be willing to administer the Youth Action Grants. So that's pretty much the history and the relationship, which my students then in my community service and action seminar, and then now in my social movements class, have been doing this very intentionally with clear learning objectives in the course. How is it that they learn about community issues, you know, in terms of what's needed in our community, how to develop strategies for community building, and seeing how young people are so creative in coming up with really amazing ideas of how to address issues they care about. Also, how to distribute resources effectively. They review the budgets and think about the good work you guys always have to do too, right? How do we effectively spend money? And then how to not only empower themselves, but the youth as citizens in their communities. So I really appreciate how this opportunity has helped my students, but also, again, this ripple effect out into the community of real-life skill building in grant development, in review, in distribution, and how this has actually given a lot of hope to my students about how to make a real difference, which I think in many ways is just so essential to overcoming apathy in our community. So thank you. And I'd like to point out, I have three students with me today. So we have Kelly and Ashley and Cece on the end. And so Cece's going to share a few words about what she's learned.
Hello. My name is Celeste Chalemi. I'm in my second year PCC, and so far this has been my most valuable term. I took Kim Smith's class with an interest in sociology, and I took away many important lessons. One of the things we had an opportunity to do is help determine the recipients of the Youth Action Grants. Since we learned about foundations and the people that benefit from funding, this fit in very well. I learned what goes into a grant proposal and how to determine who's the most deserving when you just want to give all the money to everyone. Even though I've lived in Portland my whole life, I've lost some connections with my community and what people are doing to improve it. However, in participating in this project, I got the chance to see what youth in my community really care about and what issues are important to them. This is valuable to me because I care about Portland deeply, and it makes me happy to see that youth are being empowered to address issues and improve upon their community. I never got the chance to do something like this when I was younger, but I learned about the value of being a good leader in high school, and they are skills that have followed me throughout my whole life and have been extremely valuable in other places. I believe this is a great program for both us at PCC, who learned about the value of giving, and the youth involved, who get the chance to be leaders and build upon their community. Thank you.
Hi.
Hello, my name is Sarmad. I'm an Iraqi. I came to the States in 2009, so I'm not a native speaker. Bear with me, please.
Yeah.
I'm in Portland State right now.
Slide it down.
Sorry. I'm a student in Portland State, and as being one of the Iraqi youth, I was one of the recipients who received the grant, and I would like to share with you what it did for us and hopefully will continue to do. We are the youth of the Iraqi community in Portland. We are all refugees who came in the last 3 years to Portland, Oregon. We are trying to tighten our social relations to be able to support each other and organize the youth of our community in a network that can engage us in American life as a group while building our new identity. Our project has three goals. First, introduce our culture to the other people in Portland and tell them about ourselves and our values. Second, tell others, including our parents, about the life of youth refugees in Portland and the impact on us as youth to create awareness of our needs. Third, and ultimately, to educate ourselves on community activities and build a cross-sectoral network of youth in Portland. Our project contributed to the Bill of Rights of children and youth by focusing on educating on freedom from discrimination and prejudice, and also to build our new life with love and values. Youth program of the city provided us with the capacity to bond and to bridge with other youth groups to say who we are and how we can relate to others. We understand each other as backgrounds and hardships. There will be more compassion and understanding. Every city is better when there is understanding, acceptance, and compassionate curiosity about each other. Building awareness and networking is the key for youth to have successful and healthy life in Portland and outside Portland. On behalf of myself and all Iraqi youth and Iraqi families, I'd like to express my gratitude to the city and to the staff of the Youth Commission for providing us with this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Very well done.
Who is next?
I think everybody who's spoke okay. signed up already.
Okay. Go scare him, Randy.
Good day to all you commissioners and the mayor. My name is Pam Fawn. I'm the Youth Planning Program Coordinator at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And I think the stories that kind of make up this Youth Action Grants program, we kind of wanted to contextualize it a little bit for you to understand where we're coming from in the design of this program and the design of all the partnerships that we've tried to develop. So the Leadership Learning Community in California did this study, a nationwide study about what do place-based initiatives do and how are they actually effective in building community and actually creating some action and also doing some specific interventions that actually improve people's lives. And so they created a report called The Role of Leadership in Place-Based Initiatives. And there were several, they outlined some really critical components of how we actually do this well. Specifically first, explicitly decide that race, culture, and power analysis is important in the work that you do. And that this helps deepen community dialogue and issues that have previously divided us. And that this is a specific core value, not only of the Youth Action Grants, but of the Youth Planning Program that helps administrate and develop these programs. That there's advocacy and systems capacity. So which that means it provides the opportunity for poor communities as well as communities of color, the ones that are most vulnerable and most marginalized, to actually influence the policies that directly shape their lives. And we do this in youth communities. Youth and communities rally around these Youth Action Grants, as you've seen, in large numbers as well as in key numbers in terms of critical partnerships to ensure that these are successful projects, even though there's only $600 going to James John Elementary. That's a critical $600. There's also an alignment that happens that needs to happen in these place-based initiatives. They develop and share. What it does is develops shared purpose and learning around these issues, around the issues of reducing disparity. And that as we work together across these partnerships amongst youth and community-based organizations, what we're doing is focusing on youth potential and youth action now, and that we're creating this shared understanding and shared learning in the process. And finally, there's this piece around action learning. And that we can't really know how to make interventions if we're not actually trying a few things out and testing the waters. And so what this report tells us is that it emphasizes creative problem solving and innovation. And it finds out what works and what doesn't, you know, what we need to tweak to get to the best practices. And that actually is directly what the Youth Planning Program as well as the Youth Action Grants is trying to do is make these make some of these guesses, working with communities and asking them what is best needed for their communities. And so the Youth Planning Program in this context is we see it as a youth community development program. That it actively targets neighborhoods as well as non-geographic place-based communities, right, throughout Portland, and we use the Youth Action Grants to be able to do that. We build community capacity, and we actively participate with the long-term in mind. So even if we are just investing $8,000 this year between 11 projects, we're thinking about the long-term. We're thinking about how can these communities and young people learn how to access resources, be innovative and creative about how to expand the limited resources that they've got and improve for their own context and what's relevant, most relevant for them. What we try to do at the YPP or the Youth Planning Program is to infuse energy as well as technical assistance and especially the funds with this lens of equity as well as inclusivity of all Portlanders. So for this next step of the Youth Action Grants, we'd love it if the council would approve this $5,000 shift over the PCC Foundation, and we're really excited to continue to do this really valuable work in the community. So thank you very much for your time, and we really appreciate it.
Gotcha. Other council discussion?
We have one person to sign up for testimony, Mark White.
Mark? Please be quick.
Hi, my name is Mark White. I'm president of the Palhurst-Gilbert Neighborhood Association. I just wanted to chime in really quickly to kind of just reinforce the importance of Multnomah Youth Commission and the action grants that are being discussed here. Our neighborhood feeds 11 David Douglas schools and at least 2 Portland public schools. We have 6,000 to 7,000 school-aged children who go to school or live in our neighborhood. So anything that has to do with youth is critically, critically important. And I think the leadership skills that are learned through this are also really important. For example, Ron Russell Middle School has 87% of students qualifying for free or reduced lunch. Now that's 753 students. And it's actually even beyond that, our meetings are held at Ron Russell Middle School, and I came early this past Monday to set up, and the school feeds kids 3 times a day, so they get fed before they go home. So poverty is an incredible, incredible issue in our neighborhood. The leadership skills, the empowerment that happens through the Multnomah Youth Commission and the grants, critically, critically important to our kids. And I just really want to just help to reinforce that. So thank you very much.
Well said. Sorry to rush us along. We are way over time today. With that, would you please call the vote? You're not over time. Our process is over time.
Fritz? Thank you very much for coming in to share about this important project. It's a small amount of money, but it's hugely important to those who will be receiving it and the process by which it's being given. And so it certainly shows that the council continues to remember the Youth Bill of Rights and uphold the Multnomah County Youth Commission's work. And thank you very much. And thank you to Todd Diskin and staff, too. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, good work. Thank you. Aye.
Adams?
Well, these small investment in city resources leverage, in turn, a whole bunch of other community resources, and it's the kind of, frankly, the kind of education for youth and adults that I respond best to, and that's the education while doing. So I'm really a big fan of this program, and I want to thank the entire staff team, City County, our other community-based partners, ONI, but mostly the youth commissioners themselves and the youth planners themselves. You do fantastic work. It's very inspiring. Thanks. Aye. So approved. All right. That gets us to, shall we do PG Park? Sorry, it is now called, since we filed this, Geldwin Field, right?
Geldwin, yes.
Geldwin Field. Is it Geldwin Field? I was only, huh? So I need to, this is before us today, because I need to, as transportation commissioner, send a very clear message to all the soccer fans that will be attending the first game. And I will say more after Carla reads the title of the item.
259. Authorized PGE Park on-street parking event district.
So we have the message that I need to send is the only thing more challenging than parking around a very successful Geldwin Field is 40 times more people in cars than there are parking spots for in the area showing up and gridlocking a key part of the Central Business District. So, and the reason that it's here today and not 2 or 3 months ago is really to because of my concern that the option that comes with season ticket holders of buying a transit pass is lower than we'd hoped for. The number of people that get the free on that day, transit pass, again, is lower than we had hoped for. Another sort of useful comparison where I found it useful is whereas the Rose Quarter has about, in its campus, so it's the Rose Garden Arena building and our parking structures and what on-street parking and lot parking is available, that sort of close-in campus has been estimated to have around 1,100 parking spots. Rose Garden Arena seats 14,000. Geldwin Field seats 19,000. And sort of in the same sort of vein of parking spots available either on street or off street in that same area is roughly 400?
There's 400 on street, yes.
Yeah, there are 400 on street, and there may be, you know, 200 to 300 off street in sort of the general area. Unlike our work in the Rose Quarter to manage this, which has another 1,100 spots in the Lloyd District that are not generally used at night, these games, which will also happen at night, are in a neighborhood that already is full of parked cars. So the point we're making today with this and with these game time and game event policy is walk, bike, take transit, park in the garages, which is another option, park in the parking garages downtown, enjoy the great nightlife that this city and these neighborhoods have to offer. But for goodness sakes, please do not drive to the game thinking you're going to find a parking spot on the street, because you're not. Sue.
Well, tagging on to that, the concept, this is just part of what we're doing to provide access to those timber games and to manage both the congestion and the impacts of that. So the mayor is absolutely right. If you expect to park on the street, you're wrong. You're wrong right now. But the policy objectives here are to mitigate the neighborhood impact, because we actually do have businesses and residences that want to have access, and so you're going to try and induce some turnover as a result of the higher rates. We're also going to reduce that cruising around to find spaces and cut through traffic as a result of this pricing, we believe. Not necessarily eliminate it. We're not absolutely sure that everything's going to work perfectly, but we've got the ability to monitor and adjust on that. We're going to encourage timber fans to do exactly what the mayor said. The Timbers themselves took 575 slots in our Smart Park garages to give without additional cost to their season ticket holders. In addition to that, we believe we have about 1,500 spaces in those lots that are available. Those are the ones that are right on the light rail line. So the smart thing to do is to take light rail over to the game, come in downtown, take a bus, do one of the things that will not cause you to try to park right up close to it. So there is additional contact that's going to be made with ticket holders to provide these options to them as well. The Timbers are working with us to give us access to email on those ticket holders. So we're trying to manage the whole thing. But essentially what we're doing here is mitigation and managing the congestion.
And I just want to underscore before Ellis gives a few more details that the Timber organization has been great to work with.
Absolutely.
I mean, the fact that season ticket holders have the option of also taking a free transit pass or having parking in the downtown structures. I mean, that's very innovative. We're very happy about that. We just need more people to take that option.
Mm-hmm.
Ellis?
Great. And to repeat who I am, I'm Ellis McCoy. I'm Sue's on-street parking manager. To be specific, what we're asking council to do today is to authorize boundaries for an on-street parking meter district. We want to extend the meter hours and enforcement hours of operation from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. for evening games. And we want to increase the parking meter rate from $1.60 per hour to $3.50 per hour for all of those games. These changes would only apply on game days. And we're asking for this to be approved on an emergency basis because we have a lot of signs to put in to provide for this change, and they have to be put in within the next 2 weeks.
We also, if I could, we've done a similar sort of thing in the Lloyd District, so we do
right.
have the experience of game
Absolutely.
Day differential pricing on the street in the Lloyd District.
Absolutely. And to be a little bit more clear about why we're requesting it, I'd like to go back to a little bit to describe what we want to avoid. The meters currently end at 7 p.m., and most of the games are evening games. They start at either 7:30 or 8 o'clock. With free parking near the stadium after 7 p.m., what we would have is just a rush of cars into the area competing for those free parking spaces, and we would expect that that competition would happen earlier and earlier over time, such that we were having all the spaces parked up by 4:30 or 5 o'clock until after the game. And what that would represent is no parking for residents and no parking for businesses and their patrons. So in order to do that, we feel that operating the meters during those hours of operation is a very responsible strategy. And we have the technology to restrict those operations to the specific hours that the games will be operating. Now, increasing the meter rates to encourage parking turnover is a key part of the strategy. And to help us determine an appropriate event rate, we surveyed other cities who have experience with event rate parking. We are actually recommending a rate of $3.50 per hour because our survey shows that cities increase rates anywhere from 2 times their regular rate to 5 times their regular rate for event parking, depending on how far the spaces are from the stadium. $3.50 is slightly more than 2 times our normal rate, and it's at the very low end of the cities that we surveyed. Some of the cities include Washington, D.C., for their Ward 6 ballpark district. They extended their hours to 10 p.m., and they've increased their rates up to $8 per hour for spaces that are closest to their stadium. And their rates range from anywhere from 2 times the regular rate to 4 times the regular rate, depending on how far you are from the stadium. The city of Boston and Brookline, more in particular, they have a district that serves Fenway Park, and they increased their hours of operation from 8 to 10, just like we are requesting to do, very similar anyway. And they increase their parking rates such that the customers are paying $10 per hour for the third and the fourth hour. This rate, the rate closest to their stadium is 5 times their normal rate. Toronto, in the Toronto Parking Authority, they have a district that serves their Sky Dome and their hockey stadium. They take a slightly different approach. They have a permanent district where they charge anywhere from $6 to $8 per hour, depending on how far you are from the stadium. So there are a number of examples of this. Also, San Francisco, although they're not, they haven't decided on which rates they're charging yet, they recently got authority to raise their event parking rates up to $18 per hour. So the rate that we're choosing at $3.50 per hour is roughly just a little more than 2 times our regular rate, but it's at the very low end of other cities that we've experienced.
So can I follow up on that, please?
Sure.
Residences currently get a permit so that they don't have to pay for a meter. Is that correct?
They do not in the meter district.
And so I'm curious if this is not a revenue-raising measure, but rather a measure intended to disincent people from parking in those neighborhoods, why would you have picked the lower end of the rate increases and not the higher end?
Because we knew we were doing something, although common practice in other stadiums, we knew that we would have a certain amount of freaking out. Yeah, that it's new here.
It's a baby steps approach is what I'd like to.
And to underscore, what Sue said, we're going from never having done this. So going from never having done this to doing this, we're going to see how it goes. And the proposal in front of council allows me and the staff to make adjustments as we go. If it's too low, we'll know that. If it's too high, which I don't know that it will be, but if it's too high, we'll know that as well.
I'm just going
to go out on a limb here and tell you it's too low. I don't think I'm very far out on the limb. That is not a disincentive for people to park, in my view. And if the intent is to create disincentives for people to park, to go to games, and to drive them to places where they would get on light rail, then I think it's, with all due respect, an unreasonably low number. And I would be looking more at the $8 to $10 an hour amount. And when people freak out, say, well, the alternative is to take the light rail. So there you go.
Well, I clearly...
We'll monitor it.
Yes, and I was going to get to that later. We actually have the ability to change very rapidly, you know, within a matter of hours, and we're going to be monitoring that.
Mayor, can I follow up on that?
Are you done, Commissioner?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Commissioner Fish?
Have you surveyed who's using the parking after 7 in the affected neighborhood?
Do you know the mix of whether it's people who live there or people who are working or going to a restaurant or, you know, frequenting another business?
I'm somewhat familiar with the area. There are a few businesses in the area that operate. There's some restaurants and a couple of restaurants and some bars. And there is a theater in the district that operates on a schedule. And there are some residents that use the streets after 7 p.m. as well. And there's a couple of hotels.
So if I live in the affected neighborhood and I have a permit, this does not impact me, correct?
Correct.
But if I am coming into the neighborhood not to watch a soccer game but to go to a restaurant or something,
right,
it does affect me.
Yes.
So put aside whatever feedback we get from residents. Mm-hmm. What's have we had any feedback from the immediately affected businesses?
Yes.
Yes, and I'll actually...
Could you just give us the borders? I mean, I think I know the borders of the parking district, but...
Yes, the boundaries that we're considering start on Southwest 18th, right in front of the stadium, and they go east to I-405, which is about four blocks. And they're bounded on the north side by Southwest Burnside, and on the south side by Southwest Salmon. And Salmon goes four blocks up to 14th, and there's some meters from Salmon up to Jefferson that are along 14th there.
And to clarify, the reason that they don't go north of Burnside is we don't have meters.
That's
north
correct. Of
we do have what we will use these resources that we get from this for is more parking enforcement.
So absolutely,
we can do better parking enforcement north of Burnside, even if we don't have meters. So what's been the feedback from the immediately affected businesses?
Well, we met with the Goose Hollow neighborhood, and actually their board on one occasion, and we met with selected board members on two occasions who were representing their interests. We expressed our concern about their inability to park if parking was free during the time. I am in receipt of a letter suggesting that they do not endorse this ordinance because they're concerned about the impact to residences and businesses in the area from the increased rate.
So that's the neighborhood association.
It is the neighborhood association, but they had members on the board that were expressing the concerns from the businesses as well.
Have we heard? And if I could comment on that, I respectfully just disagree with their point of view. I respectfully disagree because while this might not be popular, the only thing worse is the status quo. And
having it all parked up.
And again, the reason we were hopeful for more of a uptake, more people signing up for that transit pass, and we just, you know, but we didn't know how many people actually would. We need to send a message now that really is walking, biking, transit, parking afar, enjoying the neighborhood. That really is the best option.
And just to conclude my question, have you heard from any business associations other than neighborhood associations?
We notified we have not, to answer it more specifically.
We've notified them, but we haven't heard any specific feedback.
Northwest District Association?
Yeah. Yes.
You've notified them?
Yes.
And you haven't heard anything?
Yes. Yeah, we haven't heard anything directly from them.
Commissioner Fritz.
So we do have the letter from the Goose Hollow Foothills League dated yesterday.
Yes, that's the one I was referring
to. Stating that they would like us to postpone this until May. So the stated reason of doing this is to protect the residents to get something in place, but they disagree with that. So I'm very uncomfortable moving forward with this, given Goose Hollow Foothills League has been extremely supportive of soccer at PGE Park and is certainly well aware of the concerns. For us to move forward and saying, well, we know better, particularly when I have a number of questions about this.
In good conscience, I can't sit by and say, wait till May. It's, you know, the notion of raising parking rates is unpopular. Parking meters, unpopular. But in good conscience, and reasonable people can disagree, but having worked with parking now for over 6 years, having been part of the original redesign of PG Park, and this neighborhood has been incredibly useful and constructive. This is just going to be one of the rare times where I'm going to respectfully disagree with them.
Well, if I might just continue, it is a month until April 14th, and so I'm wondering if there might be, maybe not until May, but at least 2 weeks. I heard you say you need 2 weeks to put the signs up, and that would still get us pretty much to where we need to be if we delayed this even for a week to get more input and ask them to have...
That's a policy level. I'm going to take it. I respectfully disagree. I need to send the message now. Yeah. In addition to the logistics, we need to send a clear message to season ticket holders to take up that option of taking transit.
Yes.
It's an emergency ordinance, and I don't feel comfortable voting for it today.
I respect that.
Yeah. Operationally, though, we could not delay. To answer your question more specific, because of the time that's required to put up this.
Unless you use the first game as sort of the educational.
Right, the testing ground. And
the educational. You could put flyers in people's windows saying.
Right.
Because I never see these signs. They're up, but most people never see them.
They're not up yet. Yeah.
Well, I'm talking about these type of signs in general.
Right. Mayor, can I just follow up on another point?
Mm-hmm.
Sue, I'm looking at sub C and section. It's the now, therefore. And sub C delegates authority to you and the commissioner in charge to change the boundaries, meter rates, and hours of operation as needed. I am comfortable with that delegation, provided there's a reasonable notice mechanism to the council.
Yes.
Because there could be, in your good judgment, a substantial enough increase or boundary change that I think it ought to have some trigger to council if it wants to weigh in. So what are you contemplating on that?
We could certainly report back on it if we we ought to have a good reason for making that change, and we can come back and talk to you about what that reason is.
And I'm not even suggesting you'd have to talk. I would just say that if we could get notice, an email to council
not
offices
a problem.
Of any trigger, any time you intend to do that, and also could we, within a month of the implementation of this, just get a report from your office on how it's working?
How it's working.
Sure.
So we normally approve parking rate increases, the council?
Yes.
We do for general parking rate increases.
So why should this be any different?
Because this is really a tri-storming where we're figuring it out, and, we're going to potentially some people think it's too high. Commissioner Leonard makes a very cogent case that it's too low. We want the ability, the season's underway, and we want the ability to be flexible without having to come back every week. Happy to report, happy to. If anyone has, heartburn about it, if you want to come back to City Council, we can, but we want to be.
That'd be my preference.
It's a specialized event district rather than a broad parking rate increase, which we would come back on.
Is
the biggest advantage to that, if I could just comment, is that if we have a rate that's too high and having an adverse impact, we can change it and lower the rate very quickly by utilizing the technology, whereas it might take a month or more to come
I'm
back.
I'm referring to increases, not decreases.
Is the proposal to alter the amount of time that people can park at meters, which are currently 90 minutes?
There's two different zones, isn't there?
There's actually three different maximum time zones in that area. And there are some that are 90 minutes. They're typically in front of the businesses. Now, those would remain with the meters in operation. And typically, those spaces would be free for business customers during the events if the meters were operating. But if the meters weren't operating, they would be full of parkers, and they wouldn't be available, for the businesses.
So I'm not sure what you just answered me. If I drive up to a business and there's a space, there's a meter in front of it at 7:30 on a game night, am I going to be able to park there for nothing as I would have done otherwise?
No.
Not if this passes.
And I'd be paying $3.50 an hour?
Yes, you would.
See, that's where we're trying to balance between the businesses not charging so high that we scare away all their customers, but high enough that we really have an incentive for folks to find other ways to get to the stadium. And one of the reasons to allow us to be fleet-footed is if we find that we're impacting a particular restaurant or a particular venue in a way that is just disastrous, we might be able to, and we will continue to work on creative ways to meet their parking needs. There's a lot of movement here. that we need to account for. We just have to start, learn from it, and perfect it. Not starting with the brand new, you know, a refurbished stadium, and starting without this in place, new team in place. We've considered that. But again, and in fact, that was the leading choice up until the numbers are coming back that we're just not getting, again, the kind of uptake in season ticket holders.
Sue, I have a related question. When there's parking around major venues, what normally happens is that if someone sets the market, everyone else tends to follow. And so is by setting the market at our meters for this period of time, does this impact other parking off street that either the city manages or owns or private parking?
You know, that's something we'll have to follow up on, but we have one lot actually that we manage that's close there at 18th and Salmon. Is it 18th and Salmon?
Yes.
Jefferson?
Yes.
Jefferson.
No, 18th and Salmon.
Salmon. And that lot will be higher than this.
Right.
And I think if I could just to, the incentive will be because it will be cheaper to park at the downtown?
The garages,
the incentive. We built in this incentive, as every big stadium, a lot of stadiums do that Ellis went through. We built in the incentive. It's cheaper to park further away.
So those rates won't change?
No, and in fact, even if you didn't take advantage of the season ticket holder, say you're a casual one, it's only $4 to park for the evening in the Smart Park garages. So you can do that easily as well. Commercial garages charge more for the evening rates. And, I mean, I'm sensitive to what Commissioner Leonard said. Maybe we haven't got this high enough. No.
Typically, on-street rates do influence private off-street rates.
So if you pull up at a meter at 6 o'clock, then from 6 to 7, you pay the normal $160. So the meters are going to be programmed to do that. And
yes. These meters can do that.
Yes, we are actually, it's the standard in other event districts to actually start at 2 hours before the game so that we can start controlling the environment actually before we get there. And we're going to propose that we would start the rate 1.5 hours before the scheduled time of the game.
And again, what we have found in other cities is that, again, status quo is without this, people will pay the 90 minutes or whatever the meter allows them now ahead of 7 o'clock. So that then it's free after 7 o'clock and they filled up a space
for
4 or 5 hours as opposed to whatever the stated time in the meter.
Yeah. But it's important to understand we can make a wide range of adjustments through the monitoring program that I was going to discuss. We can change the rates during the first couple of hours. We can lower the rates. We can do many things once we get some data,
right.
Understanding how.
And to be clear, I like that approach, and I'm just signaling to you that I think as we venture into this experiment that we'll find that we need to have the rates be higher, but I'm extremely comfortable with you having the ability to adjust that as you see necessary.
Thank you. This is parking we have learned over the years. I have learned is so much like a Rubik's Cube as opposed to a linear process. You've got the amount of time you can park there. You've got the amount of you pay per hour. You've got impacts on private sector that you don't know, that are different than the impacts on the event, and it is I'm happy to come back to council after an adequate time to sort of figure out the adjustments that we want to make. If you will allow us to make those adjustments as we go and then come back and you can confirm them, that would be my preference.
And Mayor, since we have an agreement that we'll have notice before there's any substantial change under the authority that's been delegated, I'm comfortable with that approach.
And if I could quickly just run through how we're operationally going to do this.
Actually, I have a process suggestion. I can't vote for this today. I have many questions, and I want to get some more input from the neighbors. I would consider voting for it if it was set over till next week so that we can get more input, and that way it could still be an emergency ordinance. Otherwise, as a non-emergency, it wouldn't go into effect in time anyway.
I don't think you have much choice.
I, Commissioner, I really encourage you to change your mind. I think this will this will cause significant confusion in the city. And again, we're not seeing the uptick in the alternatives. We're not seeing the signs of people are taking the alternatives. I don't think people have necessarily fully thought through how little parking there is in this area. And I would encourage you to change your mind.
Yeah. If I could just,
a couple points to address
Amanda's concern.
Okay. I want to have council approval of increases.
Mm-hmm.
I do think I'm concerned that we haven't heard from the Northwest District Association, who could probably see a lot of parking in their neighborhoods as a result of this. And I guess I am concerned about sort of the message that we are sending to all the people coming to games excited, whether they drive, take light rail, or streetcar, or whatever. But I'd prefer an educational campaign on the first game. And we put flyers in people's cars and all that, because otherwise a lot of people are going to come away with big tickets. I don't know what the ticket is, but it's sizable.
Actually,
and it's not necessarily, you know, the best message to send to people about the exciting new Major League Soccer team we have here. And albeit they drive, they're centers, but they drive nevertheless.
We actually have a number of outreach initiatives planned associated with this, and I'm not the one that's heading that, but there are a number of messages that we're going to be getting out regarding where to park and where not to park, and we're making Geldwin, or the Peregrine responsible for the Timbers organization responsible for some of that outreach as well.
So the again, reasonable people can disagree on this, but Commissioner Saltzman, the educational efforts to get people to take up the offer as part of season tickets, and how many season tickets have been sold? Like 12, 13?
11, 12.
12,000, so we were able to market directly to them.
Right.
And we have been marketing directly to them. I don't think people, Portlanders and others attending these games, adequately understand how different this is
than
the Rose Quarter and how different this is. There is almost virtually no parking near this facility. Elvis Presley, you know, maybe sold out this to the Gills when he played here, but we haven't had a lot of sellouts, and when we have, there have been real problems. So our marketing efforts, again, not because anyone, you know, I think everyone has done great work, but our marketing efforts to get season ticket holders to, you know, we're not seeing the uptake. We need to send a message.
So Mayor Adams, if you want to move forward with this today, I'd recommend you pull off the emergency ordinance, set over for a second reading tomorrow. It would take effect April 23rd.
It's too late, isn't it?
Well,
it's too late for that game, but it'll be in place it doesn't stop you from doing all the things that you wanted to do in terms of outreach and even what Commissioner Saltzman's recommending, but it does allow you
to go forward.
It does allow you to go forward, but not for the first game. Yes.
Commissioner, excuse me. I don't think we have council tomorrow, and I think
I was talking about next week. First reading. Next week it'd be second reading.
So if this is set over, I won't be here next week.
That was my understanding that this was the only day this month.
That's a real constitutional problem, Mayor Adams.
Yeah, this is the only day this month.
You don't have a majority.
We have four next.
Pardon me?
We have four next Wednesday morning, correct?
Right.
We do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's what we need.
Assuming there's three votes, mm-hmm. and Commissioner Fish is one of them.
So I'm going to move to take off the emergency, so at least we have that in place. I need to send a signal to the market that this will happen. We will consider it again next week on an emergency basis as well. That will supersede that. But, folks, this is
– Well, but
– Let me finish. This is a serious issue that we can have a positive impact on up front, and sometimes we have to make stewardship decisions that aren't necessarily popular. And in this particular, let me finish. In this particular case, we need to start it from the very beginning.
You have totally persuaded me. You haven't persuaded.
I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to these two.
Well, Mr. Saltzman, Mr. Fish is gone.
You're gone next week too.
No, he's back in
the morning.
Wednesday.
But Commissioner Fish is gone. Commissioner Saltzman, I'm assuming, will be here. You need four people to pass an emergency ordinance. even if Commissioner Fritz agrees by then, you do not have the necessary four votes, which is why I suggest you take the emergency clause off.
I said I was going to take the emergency clause off, and we're
going to put it back on next Wednesday. I thought you said.
And if so, that's the law in place. It takes effect in 30 days, unless people want to change their minds. And I get a sense we can reconsider it with the emergency clause next week enough people are here.
So you're not entertaining any amendments along the lines I suggested.
What was your amendment?
Council approve rate increases. I forgot what the other one was.
Well,
although we try a trial for the first game that we don't.
You can make the motion.
Lay down the hammer on the first game. We give the education. I mean, you talk about 12,000 season ticket holders. There's also 8,000 general admission people.
Exactly.
And they're not in the contact loop. They're not getting emails, anything like that. So
that's right. They're going to get the news reports of this council action. And the message you're sending them is, we haven't entirely decided how we're going to do this.
And we're going to raise the rates, but we're going to give you a warning.
Well, I don't know if it's my place to suggest an amendment, but one thing we could do is
go ahead.
Increase. Oh, what the heck?
Go ahead.
That's right.
We could increase the hours of operations and retain the existing rate. And that's the same thing we're currently doing in the Lloyd District. And then we can go about taking data to see where we're at, and we could make a separate decision about increasing the rate later.
Or you could make an amendment to have us come back on the rate.
Ketcha just told me that they sell 1,900 general admission tickets 2 weeks out and only 500 the day of.
So that gives the opportunity to message to
right. So does anyone want to entertain an amendment?
I am comfortable with what Ella suggested, but otherwise I would amend it to say that council must approve rate increases.
Yes. And why I suggested that gives us ability to get the signs in place and establish the event district. And then we can put the program measures in place to possibly increase the rate and other things we might want to do in the future.
Other thoughts on Ellis's proposed amendment?
I think, here we are, we're having our meeting in front of you, but I don't think we should go with the lower rate. I mean, I'd be more supportive. You have your four votes if you just take his amendment to have us come back before we implement the rate.
Is that accurate portrayal of your position?
Well, I'm also suggesting we do the trial for the first game.
So yeah, and come back and report.
You can go with the higher rate as long as council has to approve any increases in mm-hmm. it. But that the first game be used as an educational opportunity, not a slam the hammer on them. Because I do think it's complicated for people to figure these things out. And don't assume
absolutely.
That people watch this meeting
yeah,
and watch
true.
The headlines and know what we're doing affects their life.
Oh, but with all due respect, if we agree to what you're saying, you are allowing the rates to continue through the game next time, even though they're not going to increase, so people who were not aware of the change would still not be aware, even though it was at a lower rate.
No, my amendment would allow the increase, mm-hmm. but to do it as a warning the first game, and then any increases in the 3:15 hour have to be approved by council.
So you'd be okay for the increased rate and the regulation.
Yep.
And the time extension.
The mayor supports the amendment, Commissioner.
The revision
I'm just trying to understand it.
So the revision. Is that we go ahead and approve this in non-emergency basis, that the first game is people get warnings for violations and there's education. They still have to pay. And then after that, we're in full force, and we come back with any changes on the rates.
They still have to pay the higher rate. They have to pay the higher rate, but the penalty, if they fail to, is a warning and not a
first game.
First game.
Second.
And then council approves increases.
That's I said
second.
That. Yeah.
Well,
I'll take both of those as a single motion.
A friendly amendment?
It depends on whether or not it gets your vote.
If you leave the emergency clause on and we have another hearing next week, then I might well be able to support it. Because I understand that you want to do it.
I'm not sure who's going to be here next week.
Well, but if everybody's okay with the amendment and we have four people here, it'll pass.
Yes.
And we have four people next week.
You're not going to be here.
I won't be here, but you four will.
The rest of the four will.
Sam won't be here.
My concern is with the public process. And
there are only three next week.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Call the roll.
Call the roll on the amendment.
Okay, so clarify the amendment. It's to remove the emergency clause
No, the amendment right now that we're considering is that the first, we will go ahead and enact the meter increases, but that we will, instead of citations with actual dollar amounts, there'll be warnings. And then from there on, it's tickets that you have to pay.
Yeah, after the first game.
Right.
And council approves.
And council approves rate increases.
Rate increases.
And who seconded it?
I seconded it.
Fritz.
This is on the amendment.
Yes.